Wally, I'm a huge fan of realistic training, but I think we have to all accept and realize that when we place ourselves in a situation as these pilots have, hazardous terrain, low weather, without an instructor on board, we've created some very, very real challenges, and those challenges begin in the preparation stage. So how might we have to look at this flight a little bit earlier, and how might we view this flight to avoid putting ourselves in this situation?
That's a good point, Bob. These pilots deliberately chose to go to an airport with some pretty low weather and some really nasty terrain nearby, simply because it was a good spot to go have a cup of coffee and take a break. Great to get the low instrument practice, but if you're going to do that, you need to do a little more what-if planning, I think, and make sure you've done some good briefings, make sure you are very proficient, and simply just going out there because it looks like a nice day to get some instrument approaches, it takes a great deal more planning than that.
We've talked before about a high-time person with a relatively low-time person, and you know, where the respect and admiration we have for the person sitting next to us may cloud our judgment with regard to, you know, really what makes sense and how far we let things go until, as we do in this situation, it gets away from us.
A very difficult decision. If you're the junior pilot and you're flying with someone who has way more experience than you have and way more hours, you're going to be very reluctant first to even believe that they're making a mistake. You have to get over that misbelief in your mind and then to decide that you're going to actually perhaps insult them by taking over the controls. That's a big hill to get over. And you need to talk about that before you start. You need to decide, you know, who's going to be pilot in command of this airplane? And how are we going to handle it if the non-flying pilot sees something that's irregular and what the responses will be? So, well, it's not much fun to talk about those things. It's part of preparing for this kind of flying.
And John, unfortunately, at the private pilot level, even though one of these guys was a former professional pilot, how much training do you have on what you do prior to a flight to avoid creating this situation? What is called upon and how many pilots are prepared to do the discussion that Wally's talking about?
None. There, first of all, there's no legal requirement. And again, there's no training for something like this. We think, oh, this is great. We're going to split the cost of the airplane. I'm going to get to fly with my friend and mentor, and I'll obviously learn some stuff from him because he's got way more hours. So I wouldn't even begin to question what kind of parameters we're going to set for this flight. He must know what he's doing. He's been flying for 50 years. I've been flying for two. So he must know what's going on. I think I would feel very intimidated in even bringing up that kind of conversation where we're going to talk about how should I recover if you screw up.
I don't even think that's in the thinking process.
Exactly.
It's not there. What this fellow's thinking about is he's going to be able to book some SIC, and that's going to go into his total time, and he's going to have 402 hours when this is over with. That's his thinking, and maybe possibly he may learn something
Absolutely.
From the old-timer.
But there are some guidelines we can look to. There are some guidance out there. The airlines, the corporations, the military – they all have specific call-outs when airspeed is out of tolerance or when a localizer or a glide slope is out of tolerance.
Right. Sink rate, all that.
Sink rate. They also have procedures where the non-flying pilot may need to take over, and they have some systematic way of accomplishing that. I had training at the airline wherein a pilot would unannounced just stop functioning. And the other pilot needed to get in and use those procedures. And when the call-outs didn't get the correct response, then the next step was to take over the airplane.
Well, our 400-hour private pilot had no training in crew resources whatsoever in his training scheme for private pilots. So certainly he wasn't aware of the kinds of things that he should be looking for.
This isn't common, but maybe
this
it's something
common.
We general aviation pilots should put on our briefing checklist.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Right. And truly, on every flight, it comes into play. If you're flying with anyone, I don't care whether it's another pilot, if it's just a passenger, if it's your spouse, truly there are responsibilities that are crucial to the successful outcome of this flight. And it really gets back to, you know, we're talking about airspeed parameters and really very specific aviation expertise. But how about the I'm safe checklist? How are you feeling today? Are you having a good day? You know, somebody may or may not volunteer this information, but was it critical to this flight?
It's absolutely pertinent to this whole situation. It is.
Ted even admitted that he was recovering from the flu.
Right.
Should he have been flying instruments?
Right. In actual conditions.
In actual conditions, yeah. Not feeling 100%.
But I think it's certainly imperative. And Wally, I think you raised the point about the pilot in command. And on this flight, there's some legitimate question about who is the pilot in command. You can only have one person responsible for the safe outcome of the flight. I think I've mentioned before at the FAA, we've arrived on the scene of an accident and asked who the pilot in command was, and had the two pilots point at each other.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, both of them are running the other way from that responsibility, whereas before the flight, it needs to be clearly established. And that person, you know, needs to conduct this pre-flight briefing that solicits information from both pilots with regard to how you're going to conduct the flight. Mm-hmm. And when that information is gathered before the flight, it allows you, you know, to make better decisions, as opposed to this case, the private pilot in the right seat is watching Ted, you know, for quite some time, scratching your head with, hey, wait a minute, this is not the way Ted flies. But we can always rationalize, okay, he's just having a bad day. Well, you know what? Maybe it's more serious than that. Maybe Ted, you know, is in the midst of a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God forbid. I know that sounds extreme, but, you know, quite frankly, there are all degrees of strokes, you know, and Ted may be, you know, very seriously ill, or he may just be having a bad day. But it doesn't matter whether he's having a bad day or whether he is having a stroke. If he's heading you towards that mountain, you're both getting ready to die.
Yep. And you need to do something.
Quite frankly here, you've seen enough already in this flight that you should be ready and poised at this time to really take positive action. And that's why I think I certainly agree with your decision. You know, he's flown through, you know, the localizer, and he's not responding. Yes, you need to physically take the airplane away. And boy, that doesn't come easy.
That's for sure.
You know, you've probably never done it before. You know, as instructors we have, and you're comfortable doing that. But in this situation, it's going to be one of the more uncomfortable things you've ever done.
I think we all agree that the course of action that's required is to take control of the situation. Mm-hmm. The question is how. What's the appropriate way of doing it? And we've got four choices here. And while you've selected choice number three, making a immediate right turn after taking control, turning towards the localizer and executing a missed approach.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I agree with that, but that certainly is a legitimate way to go. I'm more inclined to say that I would take controls, make an immediate right turn towards the localizer, get reestablished, give the controls back to Ted, and continue and keep a close watch on him. I don't know that there's a need right now at this particular point to execute the miss.
Well, Bob, perhaps you are thinking as an instructor, and I think as an instructor, that's probably what I would do as well as a current instrument instructor. I might continue that approach and try to gain some training value out of it. As a 400-hour private pilot, Ted has already demonstrated three or four times here, in my view, that something's going on with him that's not right. And I think that would be way over my head as a 400-hour private pilot. Might be good for a more experienced pilot to do that.
And one of the challenges here is as I listen to you guys with, you know, taking the different perspective on that, and that's very, very real. But haven't we kind of created an instructional flight out of a flight with no instructor on board? Okay. And, you know, and as instructors, you know, there are some roles that are assumed in the cockpit with regard to how far someone goes. But right now you have two non-instructors on board, and you really need an instructor on board. It goes back to, on this day, you chose to fly in this weather, in this scenario, and by golly, maybe we've gotten ourselves a little over our heads, and, you know, we can talk about the best way to get out of this situation. Well, the textbook solution is not to get yourself into this situation, and I think that's the lesson we really want to send to people.
And you got to think about what kind of responsibilities that you take on when you agree to be the safety pilot in this. The FAR has specified that a safety pilot is required if you're going to use a view-limiting device in VMC, which we agreed beforehand that we were going to do. So we become a required crew member with all the rights and responsibilities basically of a crew member. You can log that time as in certain conditions. You're required to have certain certifications to make you a crew member in exchange for that. But now you're back and forth between VMC and IMC. So you're a required crew member for 1 minute. A minute later, you now become a passenger.
You become a pilot, qualified passenger.
Exactly. So these roles go back and forth – That would be a very challenging environment for our right seat passenger now at this point, who's not even a legal crew member anymore, to take over and fly this airplane.
Well, let me ask this question. You know, we know probably the most important element in flying is called situational awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And in this cockpit right now, the person in the left seat has lost situational awareness for a reason that is not totally clear to us right now. And you in the right seat have lost situational awareness by your badly timed excursion to the back seat to get something you really didn't need right now.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, a little bit of bad judgment has created a situation whereby nobody in the front seat has total situational awareness. And, you know, the best way to have situational awareness is to never lose it. But right now, we're at a point in time where the clock is ticking and nobody has real good situational awareness. So, yeah, don't make that dumb choice about going into the backseat of the airplane at a crucial point in time. But how absolutely critical as it is to maintain situational awareness at all time, especially in the weather with terrain out there.
And that's why I agree with Wally that the only correct course of action here is to get out of there. You got to start the missed approach. You got to start the climb, get away from the terrain, back towards the localizer, fess up to ATC that you got a problem here. At best, you're going to get resequenced back around for another approach or go somewhere else. But to try and salvage, and one of your favorite words, Wally, try and salvage that approach, we're above the glide slope. We have full-scale deflection. You know, as an instrument instructor, you may be confident in salvaging that, what it's going to take to do that. But think about what that's going to be like now when you're in so close and so high. Just as fast as that localizer went through one way, it's going to go through the other way because mm-hmm. we're in even closer. We're going to make a diving turn towards it, and it's not going to work out.
And the other thing, you need a little time here to evaluate Ted and see if you can understand what's going on with Ted. I mean, maybe he's just having a bad day and he's gotten forgetful, or maybe he has a serious medical condition. And
well, all this assumes that Ted's going to yield control of the airplane to you.
Yeah,
well, that's true,
point.
Too. That's, right? We haven't talked about that. Suppose he doesn't want to give up.
You're not gonna, and in fact, you're the passenger again here.
You're not going to suggest that a pilot might have an ego problem.
I would say there is some doubt there as to in the real world how this would go.
You know, actually, that's a very good point, Bob, because as experienced pilots, we may find ourselves in the Ted role one day and be out there not performing like we think we should. And some other person may need to take it away from us. And are we big enough to say, you know, you're right, I'm not up to it, you better take it.
And you'd be giving it up to a 400-hour pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll further complicate this. You know, we kind of agree that the three might be the best of some difficult choices in going missed approach.
Well, let's say I'm outvoted on that.
But let me throw this out. How prepared are you as the 400-hour private pilot in the right seat to fly the published missed approach? Oh, yeah, I was paying attention, you know, during the briefing, and I know exactly what I'm going to do. And I suspect if there's terrain out there, it may be a complicated missed approach procedure whereby which way you turn and what altitude you climb to are very, very important. So now you are coming from a situation of in the back seat, turn around, things have gone to hell in a handbasket, and now you're going to fly the published missed approach, which is what?
Yeah. Good point. Who thinks about the missed approach when you haven't passed the final approach fix yet?
Not many pilots. I mean, and we all know, and I'll tell you in a classroom environment, hey, the missed approach is every bit as important as the approach, and you should prepare as well for the missed approach as you do for the approach. But how many people do it?
Yep.
Not enough.
I want to go back to what John said. When you use the word salvage and approach all in the same sentence, that should mean missed approach.
Yeah.
This right seat pilot, the 400-hour pilot, may not be prepared to fly the missed approach. His only option in taking control may be to continue the approach at this point.
Judgment call.
It's a tough
judgment call.
Right.
And how many of us are prepared, you know, emotionally and, you know, proficiency-wise to manage a tough situation in the weather with terrain out there. And your next move is pretty darn crucial. And here you are in the weather, you know, moving around to the back seat, and we may have introduced a little bit of vertigo disorientation because we all know turning around in the weather, you know, head movement may very well induce vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, this hey, this seemed like a good idea, you know, flight has really gone downhill on us in a hurry, and our next action is very, very important. Let's regress here for a second. Had we done a better job of analyzing what we're doing, why we're doing it, and most of all, how we're going to do it, you know, we avoid putting ourselves in this real tight spot with very, very few good options.
Let's just go back and do a little risk assessment at the beginning of this flight.
Bingo.
Let's see, Ted, you and I were a little bit rusty. We haven't made a lot of approaches. Gee, it'd be fun to get some good instrument work. And we've got a 1,000-foot ceiling at these airports. So let's choose the airport with the 300 or 400-foot ceiling with the high terrain. Maybe that's not so good for rusty instrument pilots. And let's see, how are you feeling, Ted? Have you done your I'm safe checklist? And he says, well, you know, I am getting over the flu. So maybe, you know, maybe a little risk assessment at the beginning of this flight would have decided that they make some different approaches in some better weather, which would have now served them at this moment much better.
We haven't used the term yet today, but, you know, personal minimums. Personal minimums for the real world are one thing, but how about some training personal minimums where we kind of bridge the gap between, you know, what we'd like to fly in and what we would like to train in? Because, yeah, you want to train hard, you want to train realistically, but in this case here, these two folks bought off way more than they could chew based upon the reality of that day.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And those personal minimums should also have a discussion about how far you're going to allow off course to go, how far you're going to allow off altitude, off speed, all those things. It, as the safety pilot, when should I speak up? Do you want me to go 200 feet, 300 feet before I speak up? You need to have that conversation before.
John, you're bringing up a real good point because this was training for single pilot IFR. If you take that literally, the right seat safety pilot shouldn't be saying too much. He shouldn't be making call-outs, localizer alive, et cetera. That clearly needs to be understood. Are we really training single-pilot IFR, or are you going to assist me, and will I assist you when it's your turn in the as the flying pilot?
You know, and just one other issue that I'll make here, because I think it's important. I think the hardest certificate to get in the FAA system is instructor pilot. How far do you let somebody go? You know, how good am I with regard to, you know, and boy, you learn a lot, you know, yeah. And you're a lot smarter after you've done it 20 years. But quite frankly, it is a real tremendous challenge. And yet how many flights turn into these quasi-instructional flights, which is what this is right now, with one guy operating very, very poorly and the other person becomes a pseudo-instructor and they're not qualified and they don't know their limitations. So it really creates a real messy, messy scenario.
Yeah, bottom line here, it seems like a real easy task to be asked to be an observer pilot for a pilot flying instruments. And in this case, it turned out to be a real problem for these guys. And better preparation and greater discussion could have prevented it.